some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's November 23rd, 2010. I'm Jimmy Carboni, and my co-host tonight is Ray Dieter. How you doing, Ray?
I'm all right, Jimmy. How are you, man?
Good. Anything interesting happened to you this past week?
Oh, God. You don't even want to know about it. The police weren't involved, though, so don't get too worried. It was pretty safe.
What about liquids of interest?
How did that go? We had a great tasting last night. We had, it's so much fun, I forget. No, it was spiced rum last night. We had five different spiced rums. It's an interesting category of rum. It's an ancient spirit. I mean, rum's been around for such a long time, and we had a great tasting. Nice turnout. It was really fun.
That sounds really great. And we're happy to thank our sponsor, GreatBrewers.com. It's a culmination of information from passionate beer wholesalers who serve over 50,000 beer retailers in 14 states. GreatBrewers.com. And also thank you to the Good Beer Seal, GoodBeerSeal.com, an association of 27 New York City beer bars that serve, promote, and support good beer. Well, we got two special guests tonight. We've got the new beer media on tonight. We got Will Stevens from BeerMenus.com and Hagen Blunt from Wandering Foodie and Huffington Post.
That's a great name.
Yeah, it's
I
cool.
love that name.
So, Hagen, this is the first time we've met you on the air. Tell us a little about yourself and tell us about the site that you're writing for right now.
I have been writing for my blog, The Wandering Foodie, for a year and a half. I actually got my start in New York City. I went to 93 restaurants in 31 days with like the entire food blog elite of New York City. And I've been on a consistent tear for like three or four blog posts a week. It's tough keeping that up.
With, you got a lot of time in your hands, man.
Other full-time. Yeah, well, you got other full-time stuff going on and trying to develop my new site, which I'll talk about later.
Well, tell us about it now.
I can tell you about it right now.
It's a beer show. Come
okay.
On.
The site I'm developing right now, it's called I Taste Your Beer. Basically, breweries are going to pay me to drink beer all year long. And nobody thinks I can do it, but I believe in myself. So.
It's nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of people out there that enjoy drinking beer all year long. Most of them are called brewers or distributors, and kind of like that.
Customers. I call them customers.
Yeah.
That's it. So do you have any clients lined up right now?
I don't. The website isn't even up yet. I'm actually waiting on my designer to finish the layout, and then I've got a coder to get on that, and should be up by the first week of December, but I'm excited about it.
And what's it called again?
itasteyourbeer.com. Yeah, so, you can get me at itasteyourbeer on Twitter. I've already started advertising for my Twitter following.
I can see that working with breweries, but like if you're at a bar and like you sit next to some other dude, and it's like, hi, here's my card. I'm from I Taste Your Beer. And yeah. The guy's like, hide his beer and maybe hit you.
People are protective. Yeah, my dad is one of the first people to post on my Facebook page. He said, not my beer, you don't. So
exactly.
Yeah. Well, we could come up with a site called Not My Beer. But our other new beer media dude is Will Stevens here from BeerMenus.com. And you actually how does it work? Tell me how you started this site, because in 6 months you went from being nobody to having more hits than Beer Advocate in New York City. How did you get started, Will?
Well, one evening my brother and I were hanging out with the intention of going into the city to grab a beer, and we just happened to be very particular about the beer that we were looking to drink, and we were searching for the beer Arrogant Bastard by Stone Brewing Company, and we were trying to find a bar that had it on tap, and we had a whole lot of trouble finding out a place that actually had it, and we had both kind of had a background in web development and databasing, so we decided to kind of answer our own thirst and create our own product to help people find specific beers. So we created a website where it's set up so that bar owners or managers or bartenders can log in and maintain the beer selection that they have on a page, and that conversely allows the drinker to either search for a specific venue and see what they have on tap, or search for a specific beer and see what places have it. So that's where
it sounds like a computer program, but in reality, it really works. You can go on and like, what do you want to find? Arrogant Bastard. Do you update your site?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we just started about a month or so ago, but I've got a lot of people coming in saying, I'm so glad to see you on beermenu.com. I've gotten a lot of comment about that. But so if I wanted to search your website for Arrogant Bastard, is there like a search engine that would just give me all the places that have Arrogant Bastard on draft at that moment?
Yeah, you can type in, right now our database we're approaching 8,000 beers available in the New York City market alone that you can search for by name.
8,000 beers or 8,000 taps?
Beers.
Beers. Different individual beer styles.
Yeah, that's unique brands. So you could find Arrogant Bastard or...
There's 8,000 beers available in this market? Wow.
It includes vintages.
I should know this, right?
Yeah. It includes vintages, so some of them are beers.
Like Thomas Hardy's from 1737.
Right. But yeah, it's a big number.
That's old. That's a little old.
Can you user update the database if they think a bar is slacking?
We do allow that. Once a bar basically indicates that they want to use the website, we don't let drinkers do that so that they can kind of maintain their own page themselves. There's no kind of people maliciously.
I could just see somebody coming home and being pissed off at a bartender. Yeah,
Coors,
like
Coors,
Bud Light, Coors. Yeah, exactly right. I'll show them.
Yeah, but for places that either don't know about us yet or don't have the time to update, we definitely have an audience of drinkers who update it themselves.
Yeah, no, I think it's a pretty good site. I mean, it kind of caught me by surprise. I mean, I didn't think it was that interesting. And, you know, you've got to share a lot of information. You know, anyone can see who's charging what for a beer and which bars have it. We don't keep it at Jimmy's Number 43. We don't keep it up to date as much as we used to, but maybe once every couple weeks we update it to kind of give you an idea of what we're carrying. But it's a little bit of work too.
We do it twice a day.
You're unbelievable. We got Jen Swerman here from works at Blind Tiger and some other places. Jen, do you guys, any of the bars you work at, do they update on beermenus.com?
Honestly, I have to find that out after the show. I've heard of beer menus, and I've looked on it a couple times, and I'm not sure if the Blind Tiger participates. Do they?
They do, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I know they have their own site, and they update that as often as they can. Probably, realistically, a couple times a week. But, yeah, as far as, like, the daily endeavor of keeping it up to date, people come in and they say, I saw you had Green Flash West Coast. Where is it? And I'm like, gosh, that was hours ago.
That's the trap you fall into.
Yeah, because people are like, how often do your taps change? And I say, realistically, several times a shift.
Right.
So
that's why I update my beer menu page, like, every 20 minutes.
Yeah, we
Ray's such a tech-savvy guy, and don't try to email Ray either. But let's turn the tables on this, because this is kind of fun. We've got two kind of, you know, beer media types here. We got Kelly and Sonia from Kelso here as well. Let's ask them some questions about beer. That might be kind of fun. My first question is for Hagen. What do you think? Are there any new trends in beer that you're seeing?
I like that a lot of people are not afraid to use silly ingredients. You guys see Brewmasters on Sunday?
Yeah.
I like that.
Great show, right?
The whole bees.
Oh, with Sam? Sam's show? I didn't see it, though.
Yeah, the Sam Colagione show on cool. Discovery. Yeah.
Whole bees in the honey, basically. Well, bee parts in the honey that they were using for the beer. So, you know, it's if you get out there and you do different stuff, I think that's more interesting. Beer... You know, that they talked about how it was mandated that it was only barley, hops, and malt, and water or something.
Yeah, water is a part of it, too.
Right. And back in, like, the Middle Ages, and it still actually mandated that hops have to go into beer? Is that was...
Well, only in Germany. I mean, in Germany, they have that whole purity law. We talked about that, was it last week, with those guys? With the
we've been talking about it a lot lately.
Yeah. The purity law... it says it's got to be yeast, hops, water, and barley.
Right. So, well, and you can put anything else in there.
That's just Germany. Yeah. The rest of the world, we can just put anything we want in there. Yeah. We can put, like, you know, dead chickens and... And reefer. What was the stuff we were drinking before?
The Humboldt. The Humboldt. Does anyone know where the Humboldt hemp is from? It's on.
I'm thinking Humboldt
where
County.
It's from red nectar.
Oh, it's
Mendocino, right?
Oh, yeah, nectar. No,
that makes sense.
So that's is that Firestone?
This girl knows.
No, it is. But, I had a bottle of it.
Really, Jen? Do you know where it's from?
Oh, really? Humboldt. Because the nectar ales are brewed at Firestone Walker. So they do the red nectar, the nectar IPA, the black Xantus. That's the nectar line that was sort of absorbed when Firestone Walker started up in Paso Robles.
It's the same folks who made the red nectar.
Oh, so this is okay. the nectar Humboldt hemp. That's what
so
it is.
So this was Humboldt hemp from nectar. Okay, so I guess out of Paso Robles.
Paso Robles.
I'm not quite sure that it passes the purity law in Germany, but you know what? It's okay because we're not in Germany. Not.
I want Sonia's here. Sonia from Kelso. Why don't you ask one of our beer media people a question?
Oh.
I know you've been dying to.
I know. I'm not on the spot at all there to think of something. Well, I mean, beer menus, if I'm not mistaken, you guys you list events also. I feel like we've listed events that we do with you. How's that going for you? Because I feel like that's been very successful for us. I'm curious what sort of feedback you get on that.
Yeah, from our perspective, it's one of the pages on our website that gets the most hits. We like to think of ourselves as different from... a website like Beer Advocate or Rate Beer that are heavy on forum activity where people are kind of chitter-chattering. On our website, we'd like to think that people are really kind of trying to plan their evening, either trying to find a beer or find an event to go to. So our audience definitely loves the event calendar that we have. The number of events that we have on our calendar is continually growing. A lot of bar owners add them or people who work at breweries like you guys.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that you know, when we started at DBA a couple of years ago, like, well, more than a couple, but the idea of the word beer menu didn't exist.
Exactly.
The concept of beer menu. Now it's like it's accepted. Like, if you go to a great restaurant, you go to, you know, the Gramercy Tavern, they've got a beer menu. And I think it's great. It speaks really well to, you know, the work that we've all done over these years, you know. But those two words would never have been put together. Until maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Maybe 2 years ago, I'd say. Even when we started the website, we launched about 2.5 years ago. And when I would go out, there was a food menu and a wine menu, and people would look at you like you had two heads if you even put the two words together.
But, my God, you do have two heads. That's a great thing about radio.
But beer menus is cool. You know, he's been doing some featured events and deals. We're actually doing an event with beermenus.com, Jimmy's number 43, the Battle of the Belgians. On a Saturday, December 4th, it's going to be pretty neat. We're getting a special cask from Kelly at Kelso, St. Gowanus in cask, and some other really cool. And actually, it's going to be a setup. We're going to have the Americans kick the Belgians' butts. But it's called it's a Battle setup. Of the Belgians. But I think we've got some American-made Belgian-style beers that are pretty good. It's going to be a good afternoon.
Jimmy, you roll Brooklyn style even though you're in the city, huh?
Yo, you know.
Yo. It's going to be a rumble.
A rumble. All right. Well, this is a good little intro to our show. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes with Beer Sessions Radio. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're here rocking and rolling. We've got a Nectar Humboldt Hemp from California. We got Jen Swartman. We got Kelly and Sonia from Kelso on, and Ray Dieter and Jimmy Carboni. This is a pretty cool show tonight. One of the coolest things that's happened in New York City in the last 10 years is the rise of some new craft breweries. And Kelso has really been one of the leaders in town. And Sonia Jacoby is a very vocal representative. She and her husband Kelly are Kelso. Sonia, give us a little history about how you guys started the brewery and how you guys started working together, because you guys are a pretty unique team in New York City.
Well, we started the brewery in 2006 after we were looking around at all the places that you could drink good beers, which at the time was still fairly limited. And what you could find a lot of was, how am I without a beer? What you could find a lot of was really crazy, over-the-top, intense beers, which we love, but is not necessarily for everybody. You know, and when we go out to a nice meal, we don't want a beer that's overpowering our food. We want something that's complementary. So we decided to focus on lagers that are layered and complex and really at their finest when they're locally made. So that was sort of the impetus behind starting the line. And how Kelly and I started making beer together was we were drinking together. It's really that cut and dry. We start. We were both working at Pyramid Ale House together.
Were you drinking alone together?
Sometimes.
Without a chaperone?
Without a chaperone. And a lot. No. No, we really...
Raise back. Watch out.
We did a lot of tasting. A lot of tasting. And that's all.
Right. And that's all? And then the brewery part?
Oh, the brewery part. Actually, I think Kelly is probably better situated to talk about the brewery part, because it really it sprung from him and hit the opportunities presented to him.
So. Why don't you jump in there, Kel?
Yeah, jump right in here. All right, so you know, I've been brewing since 1989. I was brewing in my college dorm room. I got my first brewing job in 1991, Carl Strauss Breweries in San Diego, California, where I went to college. And you know, I got a degree in international business with Russian and Eastern European studies. I took Japanese. I took 5 years of Russian. And I figured out that, you know what, I love to brew, and I'm just going to abandon this whole thing and brew for a meager salary. In fact, my first brewing job was right out of college. My first head brewing job was out of college as the mayor of my hometown. There was actually this guy that owned a pizza place. He was putting a brewery in the basement of his pizza place, got elected mayor of my hometown, and had a son all in the same year. And he's like, you know what? I can't put the brewery in. I got to prioritize. I'm going to be father, mayor, and restaurant owner. I can't put the brewery in. I can't pay you anything except for pizza and beer all summer long if you put the brewery together for me. Plus, you get a reference from the mayor of your hometown.
What hometown is that?
Mukilteo, Washington, about 30 miles north of Seattle.
Well, okay. Can you say that again?
I could. You still wouldn't understand it. Mukilteo.
Mukilteo.
Mukilteo is native tribe for good meeting place.
Oh.
Yeah, which is where we took the tribe's land, basically. So it was a good meeting place for us. But yeah, that's a different story. So I've been really interested in breweries, and I've been building breweries, and that was in 93. So I've been interested in the brewing process and being involved in building small breweries from the ground up. And then when I moved out to New York, I was fortunate enough to get a head brewing job at Heartland Brewery in Manhattan.
What dragged you out to New York?
Sonia.
We
met at Pyramid Ale House in Seattle. Uh-huh. We dated for a while, and then she said, "Hey, you know what? She's from New York." She said, "I want to move back to New York. Would you come with me?" I thought it was very kind of you to invite
women
me along, and I was like, "Yeah, what the hell? You know, why not move to? How different could New York be from Seattle?"
You know? Sonny, don't be shy.
I was going to say,
don't have to tell her that.
I was going to say, I don't actually remember asking. I think I was like, "I'm moving back home. Come with me." And he said, "Yeah, all right."
That would be asking.
Yeah, I took that as an ask.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so then I got a job at Heartland Brewery out here in Manhattan, and
worked with Jim, right? Jim McRaney.
Yeah, he was my boss for about 8 months.
Yep.
Yeah, actually, I got that job by I was home brewing in our apartment on 2nd Avenue and 33rd Street in Manhattan. And it was really a kind of a galley kitchen. I had my homebrew set up.
Not even a galley kitchen.
Not even a galley. It was a half kitchen.
Yeah, we had a dorm fridge and a two-burner stove.
And I brewed this. I brewed a porter. And I saw a job posting a few months later on probrewer.com, which is a kind of an informational website for brewery industry professionals and amateurs and whatnot. There was a job opening at Heartland Brewery. So I took the porter that I brewed in my apartment, shrank my resume down as a label, and labeled the bottles of beer with my resume and brought them down to the interview. And then
Very nice. They
gave me a job on the spot, because the owner of Heartland said, "Hey, can you make this beer for me?" I said, "Sure." So we do it every year. It's called the Not Tonight Honey Porter.
So at the time,
this is a different story.
Was it John Bluestein?
It was John Bluestein. Yeah.
What was it like working for him?
And we still brew all the Heartland Brewery beers out of the same facility.
So it was great.
So what's it like?
So I've been working with him for 10 years, and you know, and so here's the crux of the thing: is in 2006, I approached them and said, you know, I kind of want to do my own thing. I want to kind of branch out and do my own thing. So I'm going to move on. And they said, well, why don't you just do your own thing here? So I can maintain, still be the head brewer and brewmaster for Heartland Brewery, and then do my own brewery on the side.
That's great.
So it was a tremendous opportunity.
John's a great guy. I really like John.
And especially, he's a great guy. I mean, he's given me a tremendous amount of opportunity. And then that also coincided with the popularity of locals in New York City. And up until that point, really, New York City has been an import focus. Everything's imported. You know, people are imported. It's import. But just in the last few years, and we were really fortunate to kind of time it right. It wasn't really by any kind of brilliant marketing strategy on our part. It just happened to fall into our laps that everything went local, and people started getting really interested in local food and local beers. And
let's step back from that for a second.
Oh, yes, please.
I was around for a long time, and so was Jimmy. A lot of us here in this room are. But there wasn't that many great beers being made locally.
True.
And so it's like it was.
Well,
like,
but there was a big influx in the mid '90s. There was a lot of breweries.
Yeah, but they weren't so good.
Right.
I mean,
there was a Typhoon Brewery. Remember that one?
Yeah, I do.
And what was the one that was down?
Jack, a great brewer though. Yeah.
Let's not go down that path.
Okay. Let's talk about the good stuff. But
yeah,
sorry, exactly. Just bringing it back. But I'll tell you what, Kelly, I know what you're saying, and guess what? I'm gonna. Jen Swordman here has been a bartender in New York City for how many years now?
Oh. 12
with solid West Coast and roots. When did you first taste Kelso? And did you first notice what these guys were doing?
I think it would have been about 4 years ago. Does that make sense? I was working at the Ginger Man at the time in Midtown, and I was not familiar, and became familiar with your Nut Brown, which I thought was a really nice addition to the local like beer scene, because there weren't a whole lot of Nut Browns, and there's a huge market
for
that.
And the chocolate lager, too. Those were...
that's what we brought tonight, is the chocolate lager. The Nut Brown was our flagship.
Yeah, that was the first one. So I was on board early on.
Yeah. And the Nut Brown was our first beer for the very reason you mentioned. There's a market for it, and there wasn't any local. Mm-hmm.
So. I mean, Brooklyn does a brown. You know, there are a couple out there, but especially where the market was... you know, a lot of times people start, as they start developing their palates, they go like darker and sweeter and then sort of back up into hops and things. So it was there was a demand for that, you know, for something that could tap into that.
That gateway beer.
Exactly.
Right. Well,
exactly.
We did make it. We made it. You know, it was Sonia's idea to do a Nut Brown, but make it a lager. She's like, you know, there's a lot of Nut Browns on the market, but they're all ales. You know, Newcastle, even the brown ale from Brooklyn, which was, you know, kind of what we were holding up. They're very nice, but the ales have a longer finish on the palate.
I didn't remember it was lager. I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
I thought it was an ale.
No, but you said Nut Browns. That's fine.
Jimmy
always calls it a Nut Brown ale. It's all right. I give him grief.
Well, that's the category that we're most familiar with. I like the fact that you interpreted that to match what your goal was with the lagering.
Right, to make it sessionable and easy and not to build up on the palate. So the idea with most of our beers, not all of them, but most of them, is that they have layers and complexity, so the person that's into it will appreciate the layers that are really emphasized by the freshness, because we're made like a mile from here.
So, Kelly,
it takes about 2 hours to drive here, but the beer is made a mile from here.
So, Kel, mostly your beers are lagers at your brewery?
Most of our beers are lagers, yeah.
Okay, that's...
That's also pretty interesting.
The
Saison,
too? The Saison's not a lager.
It's
the Saison is not a lager. The St. Gowanus is not a lager, and the IPA is not a lager.
And how do you kind of mitigate the ale yeast and the lager yeast?
How do we put them in and mix them together?
Mix the yeast
together? No, put the ale yeast into the ales and put the lager yeast into the lager.
Oh, that's how you do it.
Yeah. I guess I don't really understand.
There aren't a lot of breweries doing lagering in this region either. You know,
it's
expensive because it takes a lot longer. It takes up tank space.
Correct. Yeah.
So you have to be more patient. And the East Coast, it's one thing that they've had.
Patient.
What I was going to say was, in a way, they are more patient. They're more lagering focused breweries in the East Coast than there have been in the West. And so now there are a few that are coming around. But, you know, you look in the Philadelphia market and you've got some, you know, award-winning Pilsner-focused breweries like Victory and and Sly Fox does some lagers.
And Stouts does some nice
Stouts
lagers,
is actually... I don't know why I didn't say that one first. Carol Stout.
Her pills is amazing.
So, so it's, but it's almost nice because we don't have, we haven't had our own lagering brewery in the New York region. So, welcome.
No, it's true. And I was actually inspired by one of the few lager breweries on the West Coast, Thomas Kemper Brewery, which was up in Paulsbo, which was later assimilated by Pyramid. And then I don't think they even have those lagers anymore. But I'm inspired by those beers, by the beers that I originally had from Thomas Kemper back in the early 90s. They were just really flavorful and interesting and easy drinking. And just you could just drink them all day long. And I'm like, when I'm starting a brewery, I want to do a beer that people are just going to want to drink all day long.
you know, set you up in the right direction.
That's what beer's about.
Hagen Blunt wants to ask you a question.
Yeah, I know you guys.
You're one of his heroes.
It's not just a brewery, right? You guys have a place as well.
No, it's just a brewery.
Okay, but
lots of beer.
I know you came from the West Coast, and there's a foodie kind of debate between the East Coast and the West Coast. What's better? What do you guys think about like food pairings? How important is that to the craft beer movement?
Well, that's it. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's important per se, but I mean, I feel like that there's a tremendous opportunity, particularly in New York, to go further with that than we currently have.
I feel like when chefs are taught in culinary schools, they're always given the wine pairing classes, and nobody really does beer pairing.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's unfortunate. I still go into restaurants that are phenomenal. The food is amazing. They have this crazy wine list and crazy cocktail list, and then you get to the beer list, and it's, you know, Stella is as exotic as it gets, and that always breaks my heart. It's kind of like you go into a restaurant and it's gorgeous, and you walk into the bathroom and it's fluorescent lights and really like kind of graffitied out, and it just breaks the vibe to me. Like I don't understand how come it doesn't carry over. And so I think there's a lot of
so you're saying Stella is like a dirty bathroom.
Well, have you had any
he knows me so well.
Beer and food epiphanies. Like, have you ever had like something that was just paired so well? You just thought, if I didn't have this food, then if I didn't have this beer, with
Jen
this
has
food,
one for you.
Yeah, okay.
And we just had it last week together.
Yeah, he knew exactly what I was thinking. I had the pleasure of attending a beer dinner, a really special beer dinner at Jimmy's 43 about a week ago, and it was the Schlenkerlaw chef from the brew pub in Bamberg, Germany.
Wolfgang Thiel.
Thank you. And he sounds
exotic.
Authoritative right there. And he made in-house sausages and wonderful soup. But the Bamberg onion was this incredible thing. And I read about it. I didn't know what it was until I got there. It's
an entire
onion cored.
Peel onion, core it, stuffed with ground pork, topped with bacon.
And then slow cook it. Serve it with mashed potatoes and like a brothy gravy and pair it with the Schlenkerlaw Märzen. It was incredible. And it was one of those matches made in heaven where you really understand. I love the rock beers anyway. I love that smoke for a change now and then. But when you pair it with food in the right way, it's magical.
Well, you know what that brings up? I'm going to cut you off, Kelly, for one minute. There's a theme that's kind of been one thing we've been learning from doing the show. Is we're talking about local beers, but then I'm starting to learn, like, you know, in Bamberg, there's that tradition where, you know, they have their beers and they have the food that go with it. But here it's like, you know, we have local breweries, but how much of the stuff, the product, the ingredients that you use are actually local? Is there local
malt? That's a great question.
Is there local hops? Has that come up for you guys?
Sure. Well, you know, New York used to be one of the largest hop growing regions in the world. And then there was a variety of economic and environmental factors that destroyed that.
There was a blight, wasn't there?
There was a blight. There was a couple world wars and a depression.
I heard about them.
And a prohibition. Yeah, you know, all kind of right at the same time. So
and it didn't survive that?
And they got wiped out.
Weird.
And but the New York hops are coming back. There's more. there's actually the Northeast Hop Alliance is based up, I believe, out of Cornell. And they're basically bringing back hop growing to the New York region. So we're using some of those hops in particular in the pale ale the Kelso Pale Ale uses New York State Cascade hops.
New York State Cascade hops.
Yes, yeah, from Peterson Farms.
Really?
Upstate New York, yeah. And there's also some maltings going on in primarily in New Jersey, but there's a couple up in New York, upper Red Hook area, up north, not in Brooklyn. So it's coming back, and there's I think it's kind of going hand in hand with the growth of the amount of the number of breweries in this region. The more breweries there are, because brewers want to buy stuff that's local. They want to use stuff that's local, and so there's an increasing demand for the farmers to actually farm this stuff, and you know, I just see that increasing quite a bit. The guy that takes our grain, we have spent grain, used grain from the brewing process, and we give it to a cow farmer who's from Pennsylvania. He's actually growing chickens for a living, but he's feeding our used grain to his cows, and then he's going to be selling us back the meat. So we're going to be able to have meat that was grown on our grain and serve that meat in restaurants that serve our beer.
I would love to come and have a steak.
Yeah, so we're going to be doing some beer dinners this winter with beef that was raised on our grain.
Sounds awesome.
You know, right. So, but you're going to see more and more of that, and that's great because, you know, getting back to earlier, we're talking about how important is the food to the craft brewing movement, and I'm a big proponent of something Charles Bamforth, one of the big brewery writers and industry leaders for many centuries, it would appear. He once said that beer. Is beer started with civilization.
Correct.
When civilization started, beer was right there with it. And so beer has been on our table as long as bread has, because they came from the same ingredients and they came from the same process. Beer is part of our genetic makeup. As human beings, everywhere you go around the world, someone's got a local beer.
It's a huge part of our history. And,
but we kind of, in this country, in the United States, it kind of got left out for a while. We were really trying to get back to center line, trying to get back to baseline. We're still playing catch up, in my opinion. And when we finally get to the point that every meal is served absolute minimum with a local beer, then we'll be caught up to the rest of the world. And we're talking about the Schenkel cool. dinners.
I think the more you grow your beard, yeah. the more you look like a local dude.
Yeah.
When can we expect?
This is a very Seattle look, by the way.
I'm going to give you a challenge. Yeah. I've said things on the radio that I haven't been able to back up, like taking trips to San Diego.
Really? You?
Here's something that we can do. Kelly, when can we expect a one small batch of a totally local beer from you? And malt.
If I could find somebody that I could get a consistent malt, because the malt is the big holdup. Is you have to have a certain kind of malting process in order to get beer out of it. I can make beer with local malts, but I can't use 100% local malts because I get a very inconsistent, kind of wacky result. But if we can get local people that are growing these grains and people that are actually doing the malting process, if we can get a good consistent malt from them, I'll do it tomorrow.
It sounds like an untapped market for all you listeners. Well, somebody go for it.
Keep in mind, I'm going to need 2,200 pounds of grain malted.
For one batch?
For one batch.
2,200 pounds.
And what's that? How do you brew? What size?
It's about 1,000 gallons.
1,000 gallons.
Yeah.
How many barrels is that?
That's about 60 kegs.
So you're like a, 30, what's that?
30, it's a 30-barrel
30 barrel system.
Brew system,
so
yeah.
So 2,200 pounds of grain.
Yep.
To brew one batch of beer.
And ask him how much beer he puts out in a year for between Kelso and Heartland.
So how many barrels of beer do you put out in a year?
Total barrelage is 13,000 barrels, which is about 26,000 kegs.
Wow.
It's amazing. The
so you're like halfway
bigger,
to
right?
Omegang, man.
How many
halfway,
hectoliters?
Yeah, how many hectoliters is that? That's about 18,000 hectoliters.
All right.
Yeah. For our European listeners.
Yeah, all three of them.
All right. This is so good, man. We're going to take a break right now. All right. Beer Sessions Radio.
Lover, please, please come back. Don't take a train coming down the track. Don't please, don't leave me. Don't leave me in misery. You would never hold me so near. You would never call me dear. Don't you know I'd die for you? Now you've gone, that's what I'll do. Lover, please, please come back. Don't take a train coming down the track. Don't please, don't leave me. don't leave me in misery.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We've got a lively show tonight. Ray Dieter's back in action. Kelly Taylor, Sonia Jacoby, Jen Swervin, Hagen Blunt, Will Stevens, a lot of cool people. We've got some great listener emails, which is always one of our favorite things. Greatbrewers.com is a thank you to our sponsor, and goodbeerseal.com. But some pretty cool questions here this week. This is from Leanne Paulson from Guilford, Connecticut. A friend of mine who is a home brewer is having a big holiday party this year. He is brewing up something special and is having a bartender pouring all night. This bartender is a friend of his, and the beer is free. But should I be prepared to tip the bartender? Leanne Paulson from Guilford, Connecticut.
You always tip the bartender.
That's what I was going to say. Always tip the bartender. Yeah.
Wait, it's a...
Always bring once, yeah.
Jen. What do you think, Jen?
I'm a bartender, but if it's like a private party in someone's home, I don't know. I don't think so.
You would take those dollar bills.
So you're saying the host should be covering the cost of the bartender.
Exactly, because it's in at their house. And
very generously.
I would think so. And then if you throw them a little, then maybe I would throw them a little.
How big is the house?
You know, 10, 15 bucks at the end, just one time, just here. Thanks. If they felt like, you know, they'd.
I can't imagine buying a drink at a house. If there's a bartender that's dedicated to doing that, there's no way that I would not leave a tip for that person.
But what I'm saying is, I don't think you have to like come with a bunch of ones to be able to tip on every beer, but you might want to slide the person a little extra if you felt like you got some great service from them. But honestly, at a party at someone's house, usually the host will pay that person.
And they're talking like a nickel.
And I mean, I'm a tipped person. I'm just saying. I don't necessarily.
Also, I would think that
you're very tipsy, Jen.
There's probably a Leanne Paulson. There's probably a pre-agreed rate. So this bartender probably agreed to work for a certain rate, and the host is probably paying them that. So
the host will tip out too.
Yeah, I feel like you can tip
above and beyond that if you feel that it's appropriate, but it shouldn't be required from everybody that everybody.
And if you really care that much, I would say ask the host and say, hey, should I tip?
Good point.
Or are you paying them, you know, very generously?
Advice
to the host: if there's a tip jar, you tip. If there's not a tip jar, you don't tip.
Good one.
So that's what the host should set, that kind of theme. If there's a jar there with
Hagen,
dollar bills in it.
As a writer who's not a bartender, what do you have to say?
Used to be a server.
Oh, really?
Yeah, definitely.
Wow.
And tips means, you know, T-I-P-S, to ensure prompt service is what it means. So I tip first and don't tip ever. Again, $10 up front. I'm never waiting in line, never doing anything after that. It doesn't matter what kind of situation you're in, if you're at a wedding, if you're at somebody's function, if you're going somewhere, just $10 up front. Well, nobody's gonna question you after that.
Well, plus, you know, I've worked in the service industry quite a bit, and bartenders, you know, they need tips, and they're kind of feast or famine. You know, it's not like that one event they're doing okay and they're good for the rest of the year. You know, they got a lot of things. I understand they got a lot of things in the water, and I usually tip at least for a couple of drinks. It just depends on the situation.
Could
but
be going always audition later.
They make more money than I do.
Sonia Jacoby.
It's funny. Everybody has an opinion on this. I think, you know, listen, at the end of the day, if you have any sort of question about it, what are you talking about? Maybe $10 out of your pocket? And that $10 is going
for free
to be,
all night,
right? And that $10 is going to be right, and that $10 is going to be so appreciated by that other person that, you know, if you have any question, just do it.
Yeah, like, but you know, this conversation would be so different if there's like a couple of Europeans in the room. If there's
but
a French
not.
Person, an English person,
but there's not.
We're all Americans. So. We're all real Americans.
So you know, let's flip this: tipping in bars in general. Let's get to the real deal, Leanne Paulson.
Oh,
okay,
talk about this.
When I go to a regular bar, you know, what's the rate to tip? Like, I'm at a bar, I get a beer. Let's say it's $6. How much should I tip?
$1.
Honestly, $1 is fine, and on a tab, on a check, if you get a total, 20% is, you know, great. 18 to 20, that totally works, and above and beyond. Absolutely. And, you know, if somebody's treated you really, really well, you know.
Now, what about the custom of when you go into a cool bar, you kind of leave cash on the bar? Does that imply that you might give a bigger tip and you might get better service, Jen?
I'll tell you what the kiss of death is, and this is what's happened for years. Is anybody who dares to say, "Oh, don't worry, I'll take care of you," they are the worst tippers who've ever walked the planet. I'm not joking. I've witnessed it for, 16 years now? I'm like, oh, no, not one of you. Because they really, you know, they're like, oh, don't you worry, sweetie.
Hey, and that's... Jen, is there a place that are really horrible tippers? Or is English worse than French? Or French worse than Spanish?
You know what? I work at Finelli's, where we get a lot of European tourists.
Right, in Soho. Right?
And
great bar. I love that
just
bar.
When, you know, I refuse to make, rash generalizations.
Oh, come
about
on.
No, really. No, honestly. You're talking to me here. I refuse to, make assumptions about what's going to happen, because I know fellow bartenders for years who size people up as they come in and determine how much they're going to give to that customer because they're convinced that it's only going to turn out a certain way. And you know what? So many times they're proven wrong, or because they manifest it, they bring it to themselves.
What are they basing those choices on?
They're basing it on stereotyping. And the truth is that at Finelli's, I mean, sure, there are people who come in and they don't tip, and then there are plenty of people where the accents are so thick we barely can communicate, and they tip me 20%. And so I refuse to determine, you know, beforehand exactly what's going to happen, because I want to give everyone the benefit of the doubt.
Well, Leanne Paulson, that was a very stimulating question. We're going to jump from questions back to beer, because the beer we're drinking is really good. Sonia, what's the beer that we're drinking right now?
It's the Lucky Bastard.
From Stone.
Let's
let Will Stevens from...
I'm trying to read the bottle, but they've inverted the letters.
And well, so... Will Stevens from beermenus.com brought this
in. It's fabulous. So,
as I mentioned, we started Beer Menus because my brother and I were trying to find Arrogant Bastard, and I thought it was fitting to bring this beer because they brewed it in celebration of their 13th anniversary of brewing Arrogant Bastard, so it's been 13 years since they brewed it. And this beer is a blend. They blend it in the fermenter. It's a blend of the Arrogant Bastard, the Double Bastard, and the Oak Age Bastard, and it's dry hopped.
It's amazing.
And I'm enjoying it.
Fantastic. And thank you for saying that, because I could not read that bottle.
Well, I want to ask Kelly. Kelly, this is the fun part when you're hanging out with a brewer. Like Kelly, he's brewed a lot of beers and many styles. When you taste a beer like this, what do you think? Like, what's the process that goes through your head?
Well, I taste a beer like this, I start thinking, it's like, what the hell's going on in here? You know, as it comes out. But, you know, actually, as we were talking about earlier, you know, when my knee-jerk reaction in any beer that I try is I look for defects. You know, so I'm looking for defects real quickly. Is it oxidized? Is it old? Is it got DMS? Is it falling apart? How does it work in the glass? Especially with beers that are shipped across the country.
Right.
I'm very critical because I like to predetermine my expectations by looking at where the beer came from. Like, oh, that came from the West Coast. That can't possibly be fresh. This tastes pretty damn good. I taste, you know, pick out the hops, obviously, try to layer it, see what comes out front. I get the hops first, then the malts, you get the alcohol in there in the back end, and the whole thing kind of comes together with a dry hopped, kind of oily, resinous-y finish to it. It's a really interesting hop layer. I didn't pick out the wood initially.
And to tie this into what I was saying, see, you don't generalize.
No, I generalize. No, you don't. I do.
Okay. But I'm just saying, see, a beer can make it across the country. It doesn't always happen.
Well, something that's heavily hopped could be masking it, and God knows what it tastes like on the West Coast. It might even be more phenomenal. It's hard to say, but it is.
Exactly.
You could set me down with a couple bottles of this, and I would not complain at all. I think what's really nice about it is how fruity and sort of estery it is, which is something that I find lacking in a lot of beers. It's just I love esters, and it's really, really hard to find. I don't know why.
Well, there's one more question for Will, because Will is very thoughtful, and I like to think that everything he does has a reason. Why did you bring this beer, Will?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of a symbol of how far beer has come. When we first got started, we were really excited about Arrogant Bastard, and now we have a beer that's a blend of the original, a double version of the beer, and an oak-aged version of the beer, and dry-hopped. So I think it's just symbolic of how far the craft beer industry's come, and to see that you can get beers that are so complex like this one.
Awesome. We have one more question, which I love getting questions. Any of you out there, email us at beersessions@gmail.com. Is that the right address?
I have no idea, Jimmy.
Or Heritage Radio Network. Don't forget,
this beer is good.
Yeah. We're on Heritage Radio Network, which is an awesome online radio network. There's over 20 shows, including cheese shows, farm shows, and our Beer Sessions Radio. But this is a really cool question, and it's about Thanksgiving. And I think that we have some excellent guests here who can answer this question. Thinking about Thanksgiving especially, beer tastes good with just about everything. I'd like to expand my beer pairing repertoire, but if I am not familiar with the style, how will I know how to pair it? This is from Jack C. from Bergen, New Jersey. And just note that on greatbrewers.com they have the beer sommelier. We plugged this in earlier, and pairing for roast turkey, for example, it said Vienna-style lagers, Belgian-style double, and all that. Let's talk about beer and food pairing, and in particular, Kelly, what are you going to drink for Thanksgiving?
Well, I think we have a all Kelso lineup this Thanksgiving. Yeah, we're going.
What a surprise!
Shocking. Yes, we're going to start off with our Flemish Red Ale, I believe, which is a 2-year-old sour,
nice beer,
aged oak aged Flanders style Red Ale.
The juice is flowing.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, wake up the palate. And then we're going to have the turkey and all the fixins with our Nut Brown Lager, which is a great food beer because it's toasty, malty, minerally, caramely, chewy, but with a light finish to it. So it pairs up with all that great Thanksgiving fare. And then we're finishing off with a little chocolate lager and my homemade pumpkin pie that's made with duck lard from the Union Square Farmers Market. Yes, sir.
Hagen Blunt, what are you going to pair with your Thanksgiving dinner?
That saison sounded pretty good. I like that with the cranberries. Nice kind of compliment. Yeah. What am I going to pair with my Thanksgiving dinner? You know what? I'm going to slander my relatives right now. We go to my uncle's house, and he drinks Bud Light. And that's what he does, and that's all he drinks. And that's
it goes really good
drinks.
With Butterball.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what he's having, and I know that's what he's having, and I'm not going to get to make a stop before getting to his house. So I'm going to figure out if I can. Make
you
sure
stuff
that
before you leave.
When I get home, I'm going to see some friends.
All right,
back in Maine.
Ray, what are you bringing to your Thanksgiving dinner?
Wow, I'm bringing a turkey.
Yeah,
drinks, beverages, pairings.
I'm thinking about
food and beer pairings.
Well, you know, I love the bitter lagers with the turkey. It goes really well. But you know what? I'm probably going to have some wine. I know that's not the right answer for this program.
Okay. Jim Swartman.
two wrong answers. Sorry, Jimmy.
Thanksgiving. So
what isn't going over so well?
I've been an orphan far away from my Northern California home for a long time. It's fine. But I always go to these parties with a big mix of people. And so I try to bring things that a wider, you know, like, wider range of palates would like. So a couple of my favorites, I love bringing the Ballad in Nora. It's kind of a nice one. That's like
nice
an interesting
Italian
one, like real spicy
craft beer. Very expensive.
I feel like,
it is
in a pretty bottle, and it's like it's a nice one to bring. And
that's
then
a real holiday
the other
treat.
One I also have had good luck with Stone again. We can talk about Stonebury. Vertical Epic 07 was a Saison triple hybrid with Belgian spice, and that one was really good with it too. And like then a lot of people who weren't beer drinkers would step away from their wine, Ray, and would actually try some beer because a lot of people think they want
away. Let's get Will Stevens, anything you're gonna pair with your Thanksgiving dinner?
I usually try to pair things that go appropriately with the dishes at hand, and I think people usually say saisons go well with the typical spices that people put on a turkey, but I'm kind of shameless with my hophead ways, so I think I'll probably go with some sort of a big IPA. I've been big into the Green Flash West Coast IPA, so I think I'm going to bring a six-pack of that.
With turkey?
Why not?
Yeah, well,
you know, some of these media guys don't know anything about food or beer, but...
Well, you know.
Okay, I'll tell you my pairing. Ready? It's very simple.
Okay, Jimmy.
I've been on this kick all week. McKellar, Czech-style Pilsner. It's a gypsy brewery from Denmark. And last week we got to host a really cool Danish rye bread project at the New Amsterdam Market, kind of fancy foodie stuff. And I was drinking McKellar all day, and now I'm hooked on it. So I'm going to drink McKellar Czech style Pilsner, and then we'll see what I move on to after that.
Jimmy, have you got one of those fancy turkeys that were like growing up, like eating
a capon?
Well, actually, you know where I'm getting my turkey this year?
Where?
Our host of the radio network, Heritage Foods USA, has the best turkeys in America.
I didn't know that.
Heritage Foods USA.
Next year, I'm getting one of those.
You got to get them. They're from local farms across the country, and that's why we have this radio show. So, hey, shout out Heritage Foods USA, greatbrewers.com, goodbrewersteel.com. Some really great guests tonight, and also some excellent questions. So please keep sending us your questions. I'd like to thank everybody, including Ray, Kelly, Sonia, Will, Jen, and Hagen for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Brie O'Connor, and engineer Nat Wiener. Nat, you're an awesome DJ. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Happy Thanksgiving.
More to the point, roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly